Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You work at a place 52 years. Yeah, you bet you got some stories to tell. Phil Knight looks back at the early days of Nike. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, I do believe, the 26th of April. Great as always to have you along, everybody. Five primaries today. Delegate counting abounds, and it's possible things will be closer to settled once all the polls close tonight. But among the economic truisms of this campaign so far has been this: the trade really matters. How we do it and who we do it with have been central issues in the campaigns of both Senator Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And the support they have found for their positions, the discontent that they seem to have tapped into, has put pressure on other campaigns to follow their lead. Why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because there's some new research out that helps explain why and how trade plays out politically. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
The idea to zoom in on places in the U.S. that were hard hit by competition from China, places that made a lot of furniture or shoes or whatever, and see how that impacted voting behavior. MIT economist David Otter and his colleagues looked at House elections from 2002 to 2010.
What you see is that areas that have been heavily trade exposed have been removing moderates from office, moderate Democrats particularly and moderate Republicans as well, and then electing more ideologically strident officials.
In other words, people hurt by trade are more drawn to conservative Republicans on the one hand and liberal Democrats on the other. There's this polarization. And if you dig deeper, break out voters by race.
Most voting districts are majority white. In those areas, you see very sharp movements to the right.
And in districts with more minorities, the opposite.
Moderate Democrats removed and liberal Democrats put in office.
Otter says these earlier votes, they're breadcrumbs. The support we're seeing for Donald Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left is the continuation of a narrative that reaches back more than a decade.
I don't want to say we could have called it, but we can at least say there's stuff that we missed that had we known, we wouldn't be as surprised as we've been.
But at the same time, for the past 4 years, Gallup polling has found a majority of Americans see foreign trade as an economic opportunity rather than a threat. Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief.
And that's consistent enough now for several years to lead us to believe that's a pretty firm attitude.
When you zoom out beyond those trade-impacted areas, for the average American, trade is much less divisive. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Hopes for congressional help on Puerto Rico's debt crisis seem to be fading. The territory is likely to default on a $422 million payment at the end of this week. Another $2 billion is due in July. Congress is considering a bill that would restructure the Puerto Rican debt, but probably not in time for those deadlines. And there are some worries growing that the predicament's going to spread beyond the island and upset the municipal bond market on the mainland. Marketplace's Andy Euler, just back from a reporting trip to Puerto Rico, has that one.
Puerto Rico is in this jam partly because of an action Congress did take 30 years ago. And it did that, why? Kent Hughes is a public policy fellow with the Wilson Center.
I don't know why that was done, why it was found attractive. Maybe it was a kind of trade-off for getting the extensive federal incentives for companies to locate there. I don't see any public policy reason why that would be done.
Hughes isn't alone. I haven't met any Puerto Rico scholar who can tell me why Congress did this. Because if the territory could file for bankruptcy, it would have already done so, and a judge would be figuring out an orderly way for creditors to get paid. If Puerto Rico does default, there's concern among bondholders that it will shake up the entire municipal bond market at large. John McDermott is a fixed income specialist with Stover Glass on Wall Street. He says at issue are general obligation bonds, which are constitutionally backed by the island.
Bondholders at general obligations generally get paid 100 cents on the dollar. They're way ahead of the other creditors. However, Puerto Rico was trying to redefine that status.
Puerto Rico isn't a state, so it's arguing its restructuring wouldn't apply on the mainland. The island also says it will now have to shut down public services to make debt payments, because the Constitution says it has to pay creditors before it does anything else. Again, Kent Hughes.
Would you really picture any state making that kind of offer and saying, well, we're just going to turn off the power to the hospitals and good luck to the patients, but we've got to pay those bondholders first?
That may sound crazy, but it's not out of the question. The island has already closed more than 150 schools and laid off thousands of government employees, and it still can't make those interest payments. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here's the math on Wall Street today. Fed meeting plus big corporate profits after the bell equals a whole lot of standing around in equities. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You see something interesting, doesn't much matter what it is, you take out your phone and you take a quick picture or maybe a video. But then what happens to that data, the ones and zeros that are all those photos and videos? You don't think much about that, do you? A lot of it is stored in what are called data centers. They are critically important. They are part of the digital future, but they suck up massive amounts of energy, which is, as KERA's Lauren Silverman reports, the very opposite of sustainable.
If memory lane were a real place, it might be a long aisle in a dimly lit data center, at least for those of us who store photos online.
When Facebook came out years ago, you loaded pictures and put them in an album that today you still want to be able to access those photos. Do you ever look at them? Very rarely, right? But you would be devastated if you couldn't click on it and pull up a photo album of your wedding from 7, 8 years ago, right?
That's Allie Greenwood. She helps companies find property for data centers with the real estate firm JLL in Dallas. She says those selfies, birthday messages, Call of Duty game scores, whatever, they've all been living inside data centers. And far from being the quiet, clean cloud we hear about, these places are often noisy, cold warehouses with roaring, outdated cooling systems.
It's hard to know exactly how much power data centers waste, but we do know that they use a lot of energy, roughly 90 billion kilowatt hours every year, and that's equivalent to the output of more than 30 large coal-fired power plants.
That's Pierre Delforge with the Natural Resources Defense Council. In March, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill to make federal data centers use energy more efficiently. It could save taxpayers $5 billion over 7 years. Delforge says a major issue is cutting down the heat from so many servers. Keeping all that equipment chilled is a big energy investment, which is why the newest data center in Plano, Texas, is trying a different approach.
So this is a hot aisle containment system. So rather than letting
Jack Edwards and Tom Doherty are showing off Aligned Energy's data center. The massive campus will soon be filled with rows of servers. Instead of using expensive fan energy to blow cold air around, they're using an idea borrowed from the iPhone. It's called heat removal.
The processor in an iPhone releases heat. The whole idea is if we can incredibly efficiently remove heat from the data center, you could substantially improve the efficiency of it.
Like smartphones use an aluminum body to radiate away wasted heat, at this data center, heat sinks directly above the servers draw away hot air and pass it across coils chilled by refrigerant. Allie Greenwood with JLL says in the race to trim power usage, companies are testing out all kinds of cooling ideas, like dunking servers in a cooling fluid.
And they will put them, it looks like a meat deep freezer, literally, sits on the floor, and they're able to run a large amount of power in a very small amount of space because of that liquid cooling system.
It doesn't stop there. Other high-tech companies are even using renewable sources of energy, like wind or solar. Facebook's sustainability guru, Bill Weil, points out their newest billion-dollar data center being built in Fort Worth will run on 100% wind power. Weil says, for now, it's mostly other Fortune 500 companies, like Amazon and Apple, making commitments to fully power their data centers with renewable energy. Still, he thinks the idea is spreading.
So it wouldn't surprise me if in Texas, many other data center companies over the next couple of years started to do that as well.
Right now in Texas, it's cheaper to get power from traditional sources. So smaller data centers will probably focus on energy efficiency before switching to renewables. That means when you're on your phone, digging for data, there'll still be some pollution on your trip down memory lane. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
February is Black History Month. March is National Nutrition Month. April is Distracted Driving Month, so named to draw attention to something that is nothing short of a public health crisis. The Centers for Disease Control says as many as 8 people a day are killed in crashes related to distracted driving, often by people who are texting or using their smartphones behind the wheel. As if that's not bad enough, and really it ought to be, texting while driving is costing us in other ways as well. The state of New York issued more than 84,000 texting tickets last year at up to $450 a pop. From the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at some possible answers.
You can certainly find products on the market that make driving safer.
In 800 feet, turn right. Then turn right.
That's the Google-owned navigation app, Waze, with a handsome husky voice directing you rather than frantically looking from your phone to the road. Most apps, though, keep our eyes glued to our gadgets. 45 states have passed texting bans, but the National Safety Council says surveys show the number of Americans using phones behind the wheel is growing. The Safety Council's Debbie Hersman says technology must pave the way forward.
Adaptive headlights, automatic emergency braking, lane departure warning systems, and blind spot monitoring.
Hersman says if every car on the road today had those features, fatalities would drop by 10,000 a year. Of course, the government is not requiring new standards, which leaves the responsibility in our hands. Fortunately, there's money to be made in helping us drive more safely, whether it's apps that help us communicate verbally or new technology in cars. 10 car companies have announced plans to make automatic emergency braking standard in all makes and models by 2022. In the end, though, the race is on for a more permanent fix. Richard Walsh is at the Center for Automotive Research.
If you're not driving, then you can do whatever you want with your device, whether it's evolved into something else with holograms or something by then.
Wallace says the first fully automated vehicle could pull up as soon as 2018. But it'll be decades before most of us are driving them. That means it's on industry and us to keep plugging away at intermediate solutions. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we would go off for these off-site meetings and try and figure out how we could conquer the world in 1 hour, and the next hour we'd worry about meeting payroll on Monday.
Today, Nike is a $30 billion company. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 13 points today, less than a 10th percent, closed at 17,990. The S&P 500 ticked up 0.2%, 3 points, 2,091. However, comma, the NASDAQ gave back 7 points, a 10th percent, finished at 4,888. There was a whole lot of watching and waiting and betting on quarterly results during the session. Apple down 0.6% during regular trading, but fell 7% after its quarterly results missed expectations badly. Twitter almost had a good day. Shares up about 4% before the bell, but after releasing quarterly results, the stock took a 12% hit after the session. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.93%. You? Yeah, you. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The U.S. Senate is making another go at federal aid for Flint, Michigan. $170 million to replace Flint's pipes, $50 million for lead prevention programs elsewhere, because Flint is the worst example, yes, but not the only one of unsafe drinking water. Cities from Parkersburg, West Virginia, to Hoosick Falls, New York, are dealing with toxins in their water as well, as are the courts dealing with it. Among the most recent cases is one in Alabama, where residents and the Water Authority are suing 3M, maker of Scotch Garden Post-it notes, to name just two, in connection with chemicals in their water supply. The EPA is going to release new guidelines on water safety this spring. But in the meanwhile, as Gigi Duban reports, the fight is on over who might have to foot the bill if a cleanup is in order.
Larry Watkins has lived near Decatur, Alabama, all his 66 years. So has most of his family.
My brother lived next door. My cousin lives the third house down. My first cousin lives in that house. All those are cousins up there. Just all family folks, just about.
He's got 5 acres, about a mile from the Tennessee River. A few months ago, Watkins went to the doctor and found he has high levels of PFOA and PFOS in his blood. Those are byproducts of chemicals created by 3M to make nonstick surfaces. Watkins' levels? 3 times what's considered safe by the EPA. Watkins also has high cholesterol.
I'm taking cholesterol medicine, but it don't seem to be working because it'd be the same every time I go back and forth to my doctor.
For decades, 3M manufactured these compounds and discharged waste into the river. Now, lawyers representing Watkins and thousands of other customers of the West Morgan East Lawrence Water Authority say health issues ranging from cancer to high cholesterol are tied to elevated levels of these chemicals in the water. Carl Cole is an attorney in Decatur on the case. He says all eyes are on the EPA.
They have, for lack of a better term, guidelines that state how much of these chemicals you can be exposed to over a short period of time.
In case you were wondering, it's 400 parts per trillion. But Cole says the issue for folks here goes beyond that.
What is it long term? Because these people that are having to drink this water every day don't have short term exposure to this. They have long term exposure to it. That's why we're seeing levels that are, you know, 4 and 5 times what is the guideline acceptable amount through the EPA.
3M was the primary manufacturer of PFOS until it announced in 2000 it would voluntarily phase out production. In a statement, 3M said that in years of medical testing, its employees have shown, quote, no adverse health effects as a result of exposure to PFOS or PFOA. Several years ago, the company stopped making the chemicals at its Decatur facility. But the problem, many say, is that these substances stay in the water supply. Don Sims heads the Water Authority here, which treats 600 million gallons of water a year.
We didn't put stuff in the water. Whoever put it in the water ought to be required to clean it up. That's it.
Sims says levels of contaminants like the ones 3M discharged into the river years ago are still at times dangerously high. He's worried that if the EPA issues new, more restrictive guidelines, the water won't be considered safe to drink, not without a very costly cleanup.
It would cost us somewhere between $20 million and $100 million to do a capital expenditure to clean that quart out of the water.
That quart Sims is talking about is about what these substances would amount to if you took all the water processed per year and remove the bad parts. In Decatur, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Phil Knight confirmed today he's going to step down as chairman of the company he founded 52 years ago this coming June. A little outfit you might have heard of called Nike. Phil Knight's new memoir about the first 15 or so years of the company's history is out this week. It's called Shoe Dog. And when we talked the other day, I asked Knight, a college runner back in the day, what it was about shoes that got him hooked.
You know, in basketball, it's about the ball itself. And running, the only equipment that really matters, at least the mentality was in those days, were the pair of shoes that you wore. And the coach that I had thought an ounce in a pair of shoes was worth 10,000 pounds in the last 10 yards of a mile. So the importance of shoes was drummed into me for several years.
Talk to me about that coach for a minute, because he was quite the figure in your life and in this book, Bill Bowerman.
Yep. He was like a second father in many ways and a great leader and a huge role model in my life.
You formed this company with him on a handshake.
Yep.
And a little bit of lawyering, I guess, right?
Well, that followed that I don't think it was committed to paper for about 2 years, and then it was amended about a year later, and I don't think either one of us looked at the document after that.
First year Nike's in business, which back then was called Blue Ribbon. I mean, Nike was a decade and a half off. You did like what, $8,000 worth of sales out of the back of your car, right?
That was 1964, the first year. $8,000 in sales and $234 of profit.
The thing that got me about this book, and it continues almost to the last page, like until the day you guys went public, it seemed like you were scrapping and struggling and running out of money every single day.
It was so much fun.
Well, no, it reads well, but come on. I mean, right?
No, it was every day you went to work, you knew what you did mattered. And it was you're around a lot of people you liked in a business that you liked, and it was very tense. We would go off for these offsite meetings and try and figure out how we could conquer the world in 1 hour, and the next hour we'd worry about meeting payroll on Monday.
This is a little touchy question, but I'm going to throw it out there and I'm going to see what you say. This book, you're pretty honest in this book, and I got to tell you, you do not come across as the world's greatest boss.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you. I think some people would dispute it. So I don't know. I did the best I could do.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're transferring people across the country right and left. You're not responding to letters. Were you surprised that people stuck with you?
Not really. Basically, the bonds were really strong. And the people, I didn't make them go across the country. They ultimately decided they would do that. And we had a mission. And for a guy to move from Portland, Oregon to New Hampshire, well, of course, that's what was needed. Or even later on to Germany.
There's a Fortune magazine article from 1984 that talking about you, and it says this: there is no better example that Nike has lost its way than they paid $250,000 for a North Carolina basketball player. The Nike Jordan brand goes on to make like $2 billion-something. What did you see that nobody else did?
Well, we knew he was a great player and an exciting player and had a lot of heart. Say that we knew he was going to be as great as he was would be a lie.
Could you have done it without celebrity endorsements, actually, now that we're on Michael Jordan and Tiger and all the rest?
Well, I think that's part of the business. I think if nobody has celebrity endorsements, we'd have been fine. But if we wouldn't have had celebrity endorsements and other people do, I don't think we could have made it, no.
Yeah. The stripe on the side of the shoe. Tell me that story.
Well, when we changed from Tiger to Nike, we had to have a design for the shoe, and who do you go to? There's no dial 911 for design.
Especially not in 1975 or whatever.
So we basically I'd been introduced to or I introduced myself, I guess, to a graphic arts student at Portland State when I was teaching there. So we went through a process, and she came up with several ideas, and we went back and forth over the course of a couple, 3 weeks, and came up with what is now known as the swoosh.
And she got, what, like $35 and a couple of hundred shares of stock once you guys went public, right?
She got she was paid $2 an hour, which seemed to be the going rate for a struggling art student at Portland State, which amounted to $35 at the time. When we went public, we gave her 500 shares of stock, which she has held on to this day, and it's worth about $1 million.
When you travel today and you see the swoosh and you see a Nike town or whatever it is, do you still get that feeling in you?
I do. I do. I still look at people's feet, and I get a thrill seeing it in unexpected places particularly. Mm-hmm. I know when the Berlin Wall went down, and I walked across into what used to be East Berlin and saw two big Nike banners, that gave me a chill.
This is now a, what, $30 billion company. It's got 50-something thousand people working for you. What's the biggest thing you've done, do you think?
Well, I think the company itself, that Nike dwarfs anything else I've ever done. And I'm real proud of it. I think a businessman can be an artist just as much as a writer or a sculptor. And so I'm real proud of what the company's become.
Phil Knight is the co-founder and still the chairman of the board of Nike. Mr. Knight, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
If you like hearing from CEOs and company founders, you should check out our Corner Office podcast. Subscribe wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Also, we've got the full interview from Nike founder Phil Knight posted there as well. This final note on the way out today, it's a quiz. There are, as of this writing, only two companies in these United States that have a triple A credit rating. A higher rating, for what it's worth, than the actual government of these United States, by the way. Standard & Poor's said this morning it's downgrading Exxon to double A plus amid concerns about low oil prices and higher investment costs for the company. Exxon had been triple A since 1949. All right, so anyway, here's the quiz. What are the two companies still triple A? Anybody? All right. No, it's not Apple, not Amazon, not even close. You give up? Microsoft, which you might have been able to guess. Also this one, Johnson & Johnson, too. How about that? All right. Got to go. We are out of here. The Dow up 13 points today, less than a 10%, 17,990. The NASDAQ gave back 7 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500, though, up 0.2%, about 3 points. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kurwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.